Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 677.EX0722, certificate number 28099, Jugglers, comma, the Internet.
Interesting, in fact, that many mathematicians and computer scientists have an interest in juggling. I think it's the search for patterns and structure that is responsible for this.
Well, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. It's been good to chat.
Luke, you are, we've just had a nice conversation.
Oh yeah, in past tense, we have just chatted.
We have just chatted for the get to know me section of the Omnibus podcast. But just to fill in, You are a professional juggler who is reporting in from Berlin, Germany, or outskirts of.
That's correct. I'm British and German, and I'm a professional juggler. And of course, we're going to be talking about some jugglers here. The jugglers we're going to talk about, not all of it is my area of expertise, but the juggling part, I'm a super expert juggler, not a super expert on some of the other topics that we're going to cover today.
What we didn't discuss in the beginning of the show was, are you actually going to perform any juggling for me today during the course of our recording?
If it comes up, I can show something. Like, I'm not going to start with that. I'm not going to lead with doing the juggling, but like, if I need to demonstrate something, if it comes up, I'll give it a go.
People do want to point out and like to point out that this is an audio medium, the podcast, and so we try not to have a ton of content that would require you watch.
I could be juggling right now. The people who are listening, I could be juggling right now.
I could have been juggling through every episode of Omnibus from the very beginning. I'm doing a little two-handed
video, and then
and then I had to chill out.
On his phone all the time. That's
do you speak German? Living in Germany now for almost 20 years?
Here's the thing. I have to, but to get my German citizenship, I have to speak a bit of German. I can do my show in German. Here's the thing. Berlin is the city in Germany where you don't really need to speak German. Like, if I lived in another city in Germany, have to speak German or in a small town or whatever. But like, living in Berlin, like right in the center of Berlin, if people know Berlin, I used to live like right next to Potsdamer Platz and also lived in Kreuzberg. In those areas, German is like optional. And sometimes it's like, you know, it's not even a majority language. Well, of course, it is a majority language, but you know, there's more non-Germans there in some places than others. So.
I didn't realize that the Germans made you pass a language test in order to become a citizen.
Yeah, like there's a citizenship test. So I had to answer, you know, I had to like do an interview, had to then do a German language test. Again, kind of basic level. And, you know, you just write a letter and fill out a form. And then you have to have like a conversation with somebody. And they're like, something, what do you do for a living? And then I say, I'm a professional juggler. And then like, ooh, and that like their eyes light up because like most people don't have a job quite as unique as that. So their eyes light up. And then I could, in German, talk through stuff, which is, you know, show stuff and talking about traveling and things like that. So yeah, just talk German for 5 minutes to some people. And then they're like, congratulations, you're German. A lot more to it than that. But in terms of speaking German, it was like, write a letter, fill out some forms and speak for 5 minutes and chat with 5 minutes.
So let me ask you, as a professional juggler, how often do you drop something and how devastating is it to the flow of your show? If you drop something, is it like, oh, I have just been revealed as a subpar juggler and now I'm red in the face and I'm just trying to like wait for the hook to come out from side of stage and pull me off?
That's interesting. I actually keep track of some of this. For years, I kept track of like how many drops I did in my show. And I would say like one in seven or eight shows, I can do my full show with no unchoreographed or like unplanned mistakes or something. And just to say,
only one in seven you get through without some
kind of...
My show is
like 45 minutes long and there's like a lot of difficult juggling in there. So, so that's probably about it. So I'd say like every 5 to 10 shows, I'll do a show with no mistakes and no drops. But of course, I am still dropping because as jugglers, we need to establish like what's difficult. I have to train the audience when they clap. And so I have various things where I will make mistakes on purpose to make sure I can set up that this is different because it's a signal to the audience that you've dropped. So it's difficult. And then when I get it the next time, and you know, you've got some, you know, fun lines to say or some, and then if you get someone from the audience and you want to do some audience participation, if they drop or if you, they throw something to you and you drop, it's just a cut. Then that's like an avenue for comedy and stuff like that. Like I can every single time when an audience member throws me one of the balls, like I'm juggling four balls and they're going to throw me the fifth ball and I'm going to start juggling five balls, catch it out of the air. I can make that ball hit me in the face like 9 out of 10 times. So in every show that I do, in one of my shows, one of my 45 minute shows where I do an audience participation, like almost every single time the audience member throws me the ball, I'm meant to catch it going to five, but it hits me in the face. And I'm like, it's hit me in the face, you know, make jokes about that kind of stuff. So that's why I say when I'm talking about mistakes in the show, they're like unchoreographed or unplanned drops. I start off my shows with things which I know are like pretty solid and I'm not going to make any mistakes. And then later on in my show, the difficulty ramps up and that's when I start making mistakes. A bit.
And if you're juggling something dangerous like knives, do you do a thing where the knife, where you miss the knife and it sticks in the floor just to establish how sharp it is?
No, because the knives that I juggle are not sharp. I used to perform with fire up until I started working on cruise ships. I had like this finale where I do some fire juggling. And then the first ship that I worked on, I was like, how am I going to try? I can't travel with like the kerosene, the paraffin that you use. And I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get some if I get on the ship. I'll have to buy some and then try and get on. And I was like, well, I'll just take the knives. And then I performed with knives for the first time. And then since then, I've never performed with fire ever again, because the audience knows that fire is dangerous. Like if you mess up, you will melt the stage, you will burn your hand. But with a knife, people go, hey, it's probably not a real knife. And then they can relax. And then it's about the performance and the tricks and the comedy and the, you know, the theater of it. People just, you know, suspend disbelief that you're juggling knives. They're like, oh, that looks dangerous. But they don't actually think, if they actually thought, if I was juggling meat cleavers and I'm going to lose, I might lose two fingers if something goes wrong, nobody can relax. And when I was juggling fire, I realized that people weren't relaxing. And I actually like it at the end of my show to not make people like too much on edge.
Right. Spend the whole show not realizing they're clenching.
And I didn't realize that my audiences were always clenching at the end of my show until I started doing knives. And I was like, oh, this is like way more fun. Like for everyone involved, it's way more fun if they don't think that like my life is at risk, their lives are at risk. The theater might burn down. There's like sprinkler systems on top of the stage. They're not worried about like a flame accidentally hitting a sprinkler system and going up, you know?
Right. Well, now, when I was coming up in my 20s, there was a resurgence of circus sort of in the culture, and it was connected to punk rock, or it was connected to alternative culture, right? Yeah, Jim Rose Sideshow Circus, and there were elements of, you know, kind of carnival, but also there was quite a bit of danger, physical comedy, but often physical, like dramedy.
Yeah.
But you don't seem like you went to clown school.
No.
And you don't seem like, you mean, I don't see any visible piercings. So what is your, what's your relationship to that culture?
Well, weirdly enough, like it's true. Like when I was getting into juggling, like in the late 90s, and I'd go along to my first juggling convention, I think it was like 1998 or something. My first big one was like in year 2000. So like when I was like 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, like when I was like, that's when I was really getting into juggling. It became like my main hobby, later my job. But at the time it was like a main hobby. a lot of the juggling, a lot of the influence on the juggling, on the jugglers and the juggling was like street, especially in the UK, street show entertainment. So people performing in Covent Garden and that kind of thing. And it wasn't seen as like very artistic, and it wasn't very athletic at the time, or not very athletic. And these days it is like very technical. It's like the best jugglers have never even seen a street show. Whereas when I was going to these earlier juggling conventions and festivals, it was like everybody there would have had a costume to put on with like stripes or spots, or like you say, the counterculture kind of thing, like a leather kind of jacket, you know.
Yeah,
everybody
right.
had one of those. They were like, let's do a parade.
Or a Ren Fair, like medieval, like kind of, yeah.
Everybody was ready to go on the parade. Like some people would have unicycles, some people would have stilts, but then everybody would have like some kind of costume. And now if you go to a juggling convention or a festival and you say, let's have a parade, everyone just turns up like with like, you know, like three balls in the hand, like, what? What's a parade? Like, what are we doing here? And it's like not, I mean, there are still a little bit of counterculture, a little bit of alternative stuff mixed in with it. But no, especially in Europe now, like there is very little connection with that counterculture kind of, or my experience of meeting other jugglers and juggling with other people. So
I think of it in the family of magicians, and
right.
you know, magicians are always, they're obviously all trying to invent something new, but there's also a real stock lexicon of magic,
yep.
and magicians kind of judge one another on how well they're able to do
yeah.
this sort of, the 20
classic
routines. And you can get up there as a prominent magician and just do routines that are 200 years old or 100 years old, and people will be like, that's amazing. I've seen all those tricks 1,000 times, but the way you performed them,
yes.
you know, put you in this other category. I'm assuming in juggling, there are the classics, but are you expected to be pushing the envelope? Does every great juggler, you know, have things that other jugglers can't do?
That is part of it. Yeah. That is a big part of juggling. Like why juggling is such a unique thing is because it takes so much practice to get these tricks for the first time, and then even more practice to get them good enough to even try them on stage, and then even more practice to get them on stage so it looks effortless and you can perform them really well, that if you're putting that much time into a trick, why would you learn somebody else's trick? Learn your own trick. Or why would you learn somebody else's routine? It's like, if you're going to spend all that time and effort, most jugglers these days will just learn that, like come up with their own trick or come up with their own routine and do that instead. So there is a bit of there are standards, like lots of jugglers will juggle, you know, like I do knife juggling on a roller bowler at the end of one of my shows, and other people would do like fire juggling on a tall unicycle, like street show style. There are some classic routines in that way, you know, like with stock material. But again, the when it gets to the more difficult juggling and technical juggling and tricky juggling, jugglers mostly will work on a few standard tricks. But when it comes to choreographing and coming up with a routine, they want to work on their own things.
So as an artist, you know, what one
you
of the things
me an
about
artist as a juggler.
Well, I believe so.
That means something to me.
Because I'm trying to, you know, as you walk around the house with a guitar on, kind of absentmindedly yep. doodling around on the guitar, and then suddenly you hit something, you play something a few times, and there's a moment of inspiration
yeah.
where you say, "What am I doing here? Like, how? What if I wanted to do that over and over? What if that was a part?
Is that a thing? Yeah."
And so I'm picturing you walking around the house, talking on the phone to somebody, you know, some German plumber, where you're like, please, you know, can you come fix this? But you're also sort of absentmindedly tossing things in the air as you walk by. You pick an orange up off the counter.
I'm so sorry to say this, John, but juggling just isn't there. Everyone thinks that juggling is like going to be really handy in life. Something falls off a shelf and you can catch it. That happens like once every 6 or 7 years to me, that something happens where I'm like, good reflexes. Jugglers just don't do that. It's not a walk around. It's not like doing, you know, these people who do like speed cubing or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
Go around. Juggling just, it's a bit too big for that to do.
So how do you conceive of a bit? How do you invent a new thing?
Yeah, just drop 100 times and then you'll try something and be like, yeah, it is that kind of thing. But you don't do it walking around the house. It's definitely like I am now juggling. This is a training
session. I'm at the gym and I'm doing it.
I'm at the gym, or I'm at a training space, or I'm at home or in the garden. You know, you work on stuff like that. But Yeah, it is a different mindset than, like, the juggling mindset is a different mindset than most other art forms or hobbies or something. And we'll probably get into that a bit later in this episode as well.
Okay, well, it's the end of July, and I'm guessing that no matter where you live right now, the weather is making it hard to sleep. It's either super hot and super sweaty and super miserable, or it's like the temperature is varying widely, as it does here in Seattle. You go to sleep and it's 49 degrees outside, and then by morning it's 79 degrees outside, and it's impossible to know. I start off every night with 3 blankets, and in the morning I can barely have a sheet on because of this temperature variance. And in Australia right now, I think you're getting a lot of snow. I'm not even sure what the weather is in Australia and New Zealand. But one of the things that helps me get a great night's sleep in spite of all these things, and this I'm talking about year round, because in the winter here in Seattle, it can be very similar. It's freezing at night and then a completely different set of temperatures during the day. I use Miracle Made sheets. We've talked about them for years on the program. Both Ken and I enjoy Miracle Made sheets. As you know, longtime listeners know, they're crafted with NASA-inspired silver-infused fabric that helps regulate temperature and also stays clean longer. The silver that's infused in the fabric is antibacterial, so the sheets stay cleaner, fresher. Of course, as a bachelor, I'm not saying that I don't make my bed every morning exactly, and I'm not saying that I don't change my sheets every 3 days, but, you know, I do live alone, and of course, in making my bed and changing my sheets, you know, sometimes I'll go traveling or whatever. Using Miracle Made sheets, you really do need fewer wash cycles. You need way less laundry because the silver does a lot of the heavy lifting for you. They're also really good, like, for your complexion and your skin, because the antibacterial properties mean that all of that gross stuff that can be hiding in your sheets gets neutralized. So go to trymiracle.com/omnibus to try Miracle Made sheets today. And you'll save over 40% by using the code OMNIBUS. And you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set just for being an OMNIBUS listener. Plus, they make an amazing gift. And I know some of you are buying presents or thinking about Christmas presents in July, you crazy kooks. So with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. You can get them, try them out. I mean, I'm not saying try them out and then give them away for Christmas. You understand what I'm saying. Get a set for yourself, and if you love them, get a set for someone for Christmas. Go to trymiracle.com/omnibus and use the code OMNIBUS at checkout. Thanks, Miracle Made, for sponsoring OMNIBUS.
Yeah, well, why don't you walk us through the internet and what that has to do with juggling, because I normally can, like, cast into an episode from the title and say, oh, all right, I see, you know, we're good, it's the Pyramid of Giza, okay, but I don't know where we're coming from here.
Well, here's the thing. When you and Ken said on the podcast, Ken's out of here, we're going to get in the listeners, the futurelings, to come on here. And Ken said, oh, you know, this would be a really great opportunity for these people who have, like, sent notes over the years of ideas and not just sent the idea, but also sent loads of research and, like, a shape for the episode and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, I feel seen. That is me. I have emails with me and Ken going back to, like, you know, 4 years ago when you and Ken mentioned jugglers on a podcast at some point, because you were talking about, like, oh, in the 70s and 80s, there used to be, like, some jugglers on TV. Whatever happened to those? We should do an episode about jugglers and who were on TV in the 1970s and 80s.
And you fell off your chair.
I sent Ken an email saying, that's a terrible idea for an episode, because jugglers on TV in the 70s, 80s, 90s, scientists or whatever, not that interesting. So just as a quick example, who are the jugglers that you remember from watching on TV? Like who appeared on like game shows or, you know, do you remember any of this or were you not watching TV?
I picture someone in a leotard with a curly mustache.
Right.
That's kind of doing comedy, but you know, like the type of comedy where he tosses five eggs in the air and one of them lands on his head.
Yep.
But I can't think of a juggler by name.
No. Okay. Well, Ken would, because he messaged back saying like the Flying Karamazov brothers. Have you heard of Flying Karamazov brothers?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Michael Motion, who had like a PBS special and was the hand of David Bowie in The Labyrinth, you know, that kind of thing. There have been like these different waves of jugglers who would be good enough that then they'll be featured in TV appearances, you know, and, you know, Flying Karamazov brothers in America were one of them. In the UK, there was the Paul Daniels Magic Show, and that was sort of like this variety show TV, and they would get all these jugglers on there as well. And now,
how much of juggling and magic overlaps, right? Juggling does feel kind of like magic, and magic does involve a lot of,
but it's
sleight of hand.
I would say they are like opposite in terms of what do you want the audience to be looking at and believing? Because with juggling, you want people to be looking at you, believing that everything is happening, and everything is happening. Everything is live. And if something goes wrong, you can see it go wrong. You know, you see someone drop. But it is a very live, physical kind of thing. And with magic, you actually don't want the audience to see what's going on as much. Like, you know, there's some magicians who do let the audience see, but generally it's like an opposite kind of thing. With a magician, you want people to feel the wonder, but don't want to see how it happened. Within juggling, you want people to feel the wonder and be 100% clear what's happening there.
So is there no instance in juggling where it looks more impressive than it is? Like there's a trick that kind of confuses the audience in such a way where they're like, that's impossible, but in fact...
It does happen sometimes, but weirdly enough, jugglers don't like that. Jugglers want you to think that what you're doing is actually really difficult, and it's kind of like a source of pride for jugglers not to take the shortcuts. You know what I mean?
I see.
I have this thing which I made a 3D printed thing with like a bearing on. So when I spin a ball on my finger for one trick that I do, the ball spins on a bearing and spins there. And there's no rules against that. But people are like, oh, so you're cheating. And I'm like, there are no rules to juggling. There isn't a rule book that say if you do this. But yeah, it's sort of like just a source of pride of jugglers that we don't use gimmicks and don't use cheats and don't use sleight of hands. It's like, yeah, everything that you're doing here is actually happening.
How long can you spin a ball on your finger without a bearing? I would imagine that just your finger alone would slow the ball down pretty fast.
Well, it depends on the ball, and that's the problem. It depends on your finger, it depends on the ball, it depends on the humidity, it depends on all kinds of things. And I wanted to take all that variability out of my show when I'm performing what's called a Brun finale, which is a Francis Brun, when I'm juggling 10 objects at once and the spinning ball is just one of 10 things that, you know, they're going on at that time.
Right.
I was like, I need as little variability in this as possible. And that's why I made this bearing fingertip. And it's still the same trick. I can do it just as well without that, but just the ball spins a bit longer. So yeah, it like doubles the amount of time that's available for me to feel comfortable and then start the trick and then finish the trick. But you would never notice the difference because I'm finishing beforehand. It's just a little bit more stability.
But now I'm remembering being a child and watching someone on a variety show of some kind getting a bunch of plates spinning on tall poles.
Yep.
Are those plates really plates? Are they really spinning on tall poles?
Yeah. You just have a slight hole drilled off center. So when you get the pole and go like this halfway down, the top goes like in a counter spin and keeps the plate spinning. So there's no trick to it except that each plate will have like a tiny little divot in it to stop the pointy bit of the pole skidding away. Put it this way. When I did it a bit, I did that. But I would never do that because, like, you break plates all the time and then you've got to replace the plates all the time. And I try and keep the consumables in my show as small as possible.
I just
hate replacing stuff in my show. So
yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, as you say, why cart gasoline everywhere when it ends up just being a drag for everybody? But you do shows. This is the thing, I guess, that most astonishes me. You're doing shows on cruise ships, and having done
Now, you know, I've performed on almost a dozen cruises, and even just getting up on stage and doing some goofy, like, slapstick nothing like I do with a guitar, sometimes that boat is rocking back and forth, up and down. I would think as a juggler, the number one, like, mitigating circumstance would be that the stage is moving underneath you.
Yeah, yeah. Gravity can change a bit, direction a bit, and when you're on a cruise ship. Yeah, but I just switch stuff around in my show. So if it's going to be dangerous, like I have fallen over on stage and knocked myself out while doing this roller bowler trick. And then I was like, I've got to come up with a different finale of my show, which doesn't involve me being on a roller bowler. So I have like literally been concussed and learned that lesson the hard way. So yeah, I switch things around in my show now.
What, they had to run out and like drag you off the stage?
Well, no, because I got up and I was like, ugh, and the cruise director was like, ladies and gentlemen, Luke Burge. And this was the last night of a 103-day world cruise. So people have been on the ship for 103 days.
God.
And the last thing they do is see a guy just go sideways in the air and just come down. So I have a video of it because I was doing something new in my show because I was like, oh, I need to try something else. But the ship's moving and we're sailing across the Bay of Biscay. Anyway, so if you just pause the video of me like sideways in the air, you're like, did this guy break his neck or not? And you'll be like, 50-50. Probably broke his neck, maybe not. And then I come down and then I stand up and they're like, Luke Burge. And people are like, okay. And then they'll leave and they'll cancel the second show after I went to see the doctor. And I'm like, yeah, you got really bad concussion. I'm like, eh. So
wow.
Learn that one the hard way.
But you didn't do all 103 days of that cruise.
You flew into just my last 5 days of the cruise. You know, I'm a guest entertainer. So I'm only on ships for like a week at a time. So, yeah. So the reason why you don't see that many jugglers on TV much is because jugglers only have like so much material. Like musicians can keep coming up with new material, learn new songs, write new songs. You know, it takes a few days to get a song down and you're ready to go. Magicians, other people can come up with the tricks with them. TV magicians have like teams of people writing for them, putting stuff together. Whereas jugglers, they learn a trick. It takes months to learn a trick and then a long time to get it ready to be in the show. And then you do it on TV and then you're like, and what have you got for next week? And you're like, no, not next week. Next year. I've got to come back. I'll have something new for you next year. And like next year, they might be featured on another talk show and stuff like that. And this happens to lots of jugglers. They'll go on TV and it doesn't matter how much of a hit they are. Like when I was getting into juggling, when I was just becoming a professional juggler, I met these Russian kids, Olga and Vova Galchenko, and they had, you know, from somewhere in Russia, and they went over to the United States and they were featured, you know, on the Oprah show and on the Ellen DeGeneres show and, you know, featured here in these news programs. Like, look at these, you know, child prodigy kids. They're like 13 and 15 years old and they were absolutely amazing. And they're amazing. They're absolutely amazing jugglers. But you can only do that for like two or three or four TV appearances. And then like the world is like, all right, jugglers, what else have you got? And us jugglers are like, that's about it.
Right.
Like, I've got like, you know, 10 routines that I do in my two shows. And once I've gone through them, like, I'm not like a stand-up comedian who can come back with another 5 minutes next week and appear on the TV show, on the chat show, on the, you know, Johnny Carson show. It's like, no, the jugglers, they do their act. And then it's sort of like, okay, that's it. And magicians and musicians and comedians, there's always a bit more material. It takes less effort to get through the more material, whereas us jugglers don't. So this is why I was saying to Ken, you know, and emails like that, don't, like, you've only got so many times that you can see Vova and Olga Galchenko on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and they're not going to be invited back. Whereas like a movie star would be invited back each time they come out with a new movie, every musician with a new album or a new single, yeah, you can invite back. But jugglers, it doesn't work that way. So I told Ken, what you need to do is you need to talk about some of the most famous and influential and important jugglers in the world who are not known for their juggling, but for something else. And that's what today's episode is going to be. So, like, I'm an expert at juggling. I know a lot about juggling, but we're going to be talking about computer math, which I'm not an expert in. I didn't do that. You know, I don't do that as a job, but I know enough to be dangerous to go into some of these examples.
So how many of these, how many situations are there where a person is a juggler and then develops other skills? And how many of these are situations where someone is only juggling as a side, you know, as a way of like doing math computations in the air.
That's and then what we're going to be talking about.
Oh, so all right,
we,
good.
We go through, so should we go through some of these examples here?
I would love to.
This is we're in the episode now. Let's get into it. So do you know, have you ever heard of Claude Shannon?
No, 100% I can confirm I have never heard of Claude Shannon.
Claude Shannon should be, in my estimation, not just because he was a juggler, he should be as famous as Einstein and, you know, Isaac Newton and stuff, because he invented computers. Claude Shannon, yeah. His master's thesis invented, like, what computers are, to the point where, have you ever heard of a bit?
Oh, yes, I know what a bit is. Well, right, I've seen the movie...
Bit. What Claude Shannon did in his master's thesis, when he was like still at university, he wrote a paper, as his master's thesis, called A Symbolic Analysis of Relay and Switching Circuits, where he was like, hey, you know what we can do is we can use switches to like kind of encode computer... Well, before they even called computers, we can use this electrical signaling to switch relays, like, you know, the automatic, you know, telephone exchanges kind of relay stuff. He's sort of like, we can do Boolean mathematics. So if you've ever heard of like when people talking about computers where you're like logic, like what's the logic of this? And they're like this and that, this not that, this not and that, and all these other kind of stuff. One guy came up with the idea that you could do this with switches. And this guy...
This is just like on, off, one and zero.
Ones and zeros. So he's like, what we should do is we shouldn't try and calculate things in analog ways, and we shouldn't try and count to 10. What we should do, we should reduce everything down to on or off, one or zero, a one and a zero, that's all we need. And what we can do, we can encode all mathematical and every problem, if we encode it down into ones and zeros, we can run it through like switches and like what now we call digital, like transistors, digital computers, logic gates, which are like the foundational parts of computers, foundational parts of computers. He was like, I reckon we can do all of this. And if it's on or off, we'll call that one bit of information. And it's a bit because it's irreducible. You can't get lower than one or zero. And
one and zero are also, they're analogous to true and false,
true,
right?
Because that's what the Boolean logic, the Boolean algebra was. And he says, we can apply this true and falseness to information. And he invented in this, which is literally what all computers are now. Because lots of people think, oh, you know, what about like the Enigma machine and, you know, Alan Turing and things like that. But the Enigma machine, you know, at Bletchley Park over there, their computers, the Colossus computers, they counted from 1 to 10. So you'd have 0 to 9, let me put it that way. So you'd have a row and this is ones and this is tens and this is, but it only went up so far.
Yeah,
and so it's kind of like a computing that was a computing dead end. They didn't know it at the time, but it was a computing dead end. And a few years before, like I say, in 1937, Claude Shannon had written his master's thesis, which literally said, let's just get everything down to ones and zeros. And if we bring everything down to ones and zeros, from there, we can then build up all of computing.
I'm so embarrassed to have said so emphatically that I didn't know who Claude Shannon is, because, I mean, obviously this is something that Ken, if you asked any of these questions, Ken would know all about it. And normally I'm very good at going, and that leaves me a plausible, in people's imaginations, it's plausible. They're like, oh, John probably knew all that. He was just pretending that he didn't.
Yeah.
But in this case, I said, I don't know who Claude Shannon is, and I'm sure tens of thousands of futurelings like rolled their eyes to death.
No, I'm not even sure. I'm not even sure, because again, he's not a well-known, you know, mathematician or science guy.
Why is that? Why is he not? Why is there not a statue of him in Piccadilly Square?
There are statues of him in MIT and stuff like that. Like but the thing is, among the people who know who Claude Shannon is, it's like he's so foundational that it's just assumed that everything you are doing on a computer is like post Claude Shannon computing.
Right.
That's why I say it's like Darwin. It's like, you know, Isaac Newton. It's like Einstein. Like they do the thing in their field, which after that, it's like they're so assumed to, like, that you're working within their framework. That if people do something which doesn't have Claude Shannon's fingerprints on it, it's like not even computer science anymore. It's not even information theory. Like, he is like right at the core of those things. So
wow, that's fantastic.
The first thing he did. Later on, a few years later, 10 years later, he published a mathematical theory of communication, which is like, all right, we've got ones and zeros here. But then when we send these ones and zeros to another thing, if we're communicating between two systems, how do you know if the other side has got the correct message?
Yeah, right. And what if they missed the first one or zero, whole thing is going to be upside down.
Real Enigma machine kind of thing. Like, the first code that they send in the Enigma machine is like, what's the code for the day? And if you miss that, it's like, you don't know what the code is for the day or whatever. I don't know enough about Enigma machines. But, you know, it's that kind of thing. And so when he wrote this, the mathematical theory of communication, it kind of founded an entire new form of mathematics, which is, you know, information theory. And that's why Claude Shannon is known as the father of information theory, which is all about how far you can reduce a signal of ones and zeros down to, like, compress it to, first of all, how small you can get it. And if you get it down to the Shannon limit, anything below that is then is like noise. It's like indistinguishable from noise. And there's only so deep or so deeply you can compress something. And then also, how does the other people know that you've got it? And so pretty much these papers and other papers that he wrote are foundational, not just to like how the internet works, but like all of modern computing comes down to this one guy, Claude Shannon, and he was a juggler. Of course, that's the thing is this. In the juggling world, he is known for the Shannon's theory of juggling. Outside of this, I mean, he is so famous in so many other things. You know, you can see uncountable videos about him as well. But yes, he made, he made Shannon's juggling theorem. Also made a juggling robot, which was a bounce juggling robot. And it's a really fun little thing. It's sort of like, he called him W.C. Fields. And it was like this thing where the balls bounce backwards and forwards. It's the very first juggling robot. Another robot he made was a mouse, which went around the maze, was the first example of machine learning, because the mouse had like these sensors underneath it, and it could track where it was, learn where it was, and then you could put the mouse down anyway, it would find where it was, and then start learning the fastest ways between it. And it's the first ever example of machine learning.
He was a robot builder too?
Yeah, not just juggling robots. The more important robots are the mouse robot. He also came up with the idea of not just compressing information, but once you get down to a certain level of information compression, what you're doing is you're actually predicting what the next thing could be. And that's why this blocky video that I'm looking at you in this podcast thing is all blocky, because they're like, we don't have to give all the information. We'll just like predict that it's probably going to be the same bookcase behind John. And it'll just be that for a long time. And he came up with this idea and was the first person to work out like what would be the next thing, what would be the next word in an English sentence. And he sat there with his wife and went over this and over this and over this. And what he came up with was just like a model to predict what the next word would be in a sentence. And if this is feeling familiar to you, this is because this is like the basis of large language models and, you know, prediction models, which is why now one of the two big AI companies, you've got, you know, OpenAI with their OpenAI thing, and you've also got Anthropic, and their AI is called Claude. And it's named Claude because it's named after Claude Shannon, who invented like all of this kind of stuff.
Okay? Wow.
So,
and it's why none of us can spell anymore.
Yeah.
Because every
cloud.
Yeah. That's so incredible. Why is this all news? There's got to be a reason,
John. Ken knows all this stuff.
I know he does.
This would be a Ken episode. I sent this email to Ken saying, "Look, you can fill in. Like, he knows more. Like, Ken knows more about this computer stuff than I do. Like, I'm just like, you know, remembering stuff from."
But Ken knows John Adams's like waist size. Ken knows a lot of things that the rest of us don't. But why was this not taught to us in school. Why, like you say, why is Claude Shannon not as well known as Einstein?
Again, in computer science circles, he is like not just well known, it's like the foundation of everything that you do. And that's why he's now got, I think it could be that he might be more famous for like Claude AI being named after him. If you say Claude now, but I sent this email to John before Claude was even a thing, because I sent this email to him like 4 years ago or something.
You're talking about Ken. You sent it to Ken. I am John, and I didn't get this email.
Maybe Mindy got it, but not John. I can tell you that. So yeah, we got to move on. More examples. Okay, so let's move on from Claude Shannon after we've had the reveal.
Yes.
He also invented large language models and is the foundation of, you know, machine learning as well. So you did a show recently? Did you do one about the self-driving cars? I think that was the DARPA, was it the DARPA challenge?
The DARPA challenge.
Okay, so DARPA is also ARPA, and then there was a thing called ARPANET, which you might have heard about ARPANET. It was the way of connecting, you know, military places. It was like, you know, like a military program to like, how do we connect all this stuff together?
That's the thing. If it's connected at all to the Cold War or any kind of fighting the Russians, then I'll know all about it.
So ARPANET was a project where like the U.S. government was, or the Defense Department or whoever it was, I can't remember, was like, hey, we want like a switching network with like redundancy and you know routers and all this kind of stuff. And they're like, who wants to do this? And they like opened it up for people to compete for the, you know, to bid for it. And the company that ended up building ARPANET was called BBN Technologies. BBN Technologies, based in Boston/Cambridge or wherever that area is there, was taken over by jugglers. And this is how I knew a lot of this, because I was into juggling and met lots of other jugglers who were talking about the legends of the people who were building the internet at, you know, ARPANET and BBN Technologies were all jugglers. Okay. Now there's this thing called the International Jugglers Association, which actually started as a part of the magician circle kind of thing. And there was a lot of jugglers and they were like, hey, we should have one of these for us. So they had a jugglers meetup at one of these magic circle meetings or whatever. And then the jugglers started having their own newsletter and their own meetings. So there's been, you know, yearly, for like the last 70 years, there's been yearly annual juggling meetups in various places around North America. So ARPANET, built by BBN Technologies. The guy, and I heard stories about this. And when it came to this episode, when Grant called me and said, all right, get together your research, make sure you got all the notes. I started researching this and I was like, I know about this by a word of mouth, but like I couldn't find it. But then I did find some stuff about this. You know, I found some scans of some magazine articles and some oral histories about people who worked on ARPANET. And there's this guy called Dave Walden, and he's written bits and pieces about this. And again, this is stuff that I'd heard like secondhand, third-hand knowledge back like 25 years ago. But I did find some stuff about it, which it said here, there was a juggling phase at BBN Technology. It spread to other early internet sites. So what happened was a few people who were working on ARPANET at BBN Technologies started learning to juggling, and then they would message other people about juggling. And when they were doing meetups and scientific stuff, all the jugglers would get together.
It was a use case for the internet. The only reason that they wanted to talk to each other was juggling.
You're closer than you think, because what happened, these guys volunteered to start running the International Jugglers Association festivals, and it didn't happen straight away. But one of them volunteered to do the newsletter. And the way the newsletter worked is, this was before the internet, you couldn't just look up people anywhere. So it would be the name and address and phone number of every member of the International Jugglers Association would be posted out every year or every few months, or depending on what the circulation was at the time. It changed over the years with all the people. So if you were traveling around and you visited a new place, you could look up who were the jugglers here, and then you could meet up. It was like a social network before there were social networks, this newsletter with the names and addresses and telephone numbers of everybody in an association of like 500 people or whatever it was at the time. And so what happened was that BBN, this company, was like, oh, we can run that on our computers. So the BBN, which was the people building ARPANET, became the headquarters of the International Jugglers Association, run by people who were there at, you know, at the foundation of ARPANET. And this was in the like late 1970s. Well, let's move on to our next star of the show.
We've talked
about Erdos numbers. You've talked about Erdos. You did an episode
at great length.
What's that? Bacon numbers? What was it? I can't remember.
Yeah, Bacon Erdos Sabbath numbers.
Oh, Sabbath. That was the one I
came. And this comes up all the time in my life now. The fact that we did that show, people come up and want to talk about their Very few people have a Bacon Erdős Sabbath number. I can count them on one hand. But
okay, Erdős didn't come up with the idea of Erdős numbers. Somebody else came up with the Erdős number and popularized it. And his name was Ron Graham. Have you ever heard of Ron Graham?
Well, if we didn't discuss it in the Bacon Erdős Sabbath episode,
he was the guy who had the guy who put Erdős up in his house and was like one of the main guys who popularized the Erdős numbers. He was also famous for having the largest number ever used in a mathematical proof for a long time. Graham's number was classed as one of the world's biggest numbers, the largest number. Of course, you can just say Graham's number plus one, but he used it to prove something to be honest, way beyond anything that I can ever understand about this. Anyway, he worked at Bell Labs. He was the director of technologies or like director of research at Bell Labs for a while. He does lots of signal stuff. I don't know. Again, this is a little bit tenuous of building the internet, but like he's like among mathematicians. If I say Ron Graham, everyone is like, oh yeah, Graham's number, Erdős number. Like everybody knows this guy as well.
Yeah.
Turns out he was also the president of the International Jugglers Association. So he's like right there, you know, like right
well,
there.
Well, now, did he come at that because that he was interacting with people at MIT and they were like, hey, you know what you need to get into?
It's all MIT. It's all Boston. It's all MIT. Of course, you know, where's Bell Labs? Like Princeton. You know, it's all of these like schools, everyone coming up to each other and all bumping into each other. All this guy. There's some,
but it isn't an affinity for juggling that brought him into math. It was math that brought him into juggling.
It's the same mindset. And it's really funny because I was reading, because I was doing this research, I found some fun, like people writing on their blogs were sort of like, yeah. And then I was at the IJA festival and someone said, I said, oh, what's your name? And he's like, I'm Claude. And he's like, this could be. And it's like, Claude? He's like, Claude Shannon. And he's like, I'm like, mind blown because he's like this mathematician and computer scientist. And then Claude Shannon's like, oh yeah, come back to my house, and goes back to the house and sees the juggling machines and sees like the first ever learning computer. And of course, Claude Shannon was at the IGA festivals because he's a juggler, you know, and all these other people were there because they were jugglers and maybe met through universities or got into juggling via these juggling.
So many of the jugglers wouldn't have even known who Claude Shannon was as a mathematician.
But the mathematicians at the IJA festival were looking at Claude Shannon and going, holy shit, that's Claude Shannon. And also, Ron Graham is the president of the International Jugglers Association. So like world famous, you know, mathematicians and, you know, directors of research at Bell Labs. Like it's the crossover between jugglers and this computer maths world is, again, it's not a perfect Venn diagram circle, but there's like a big blob in the middle there where it's overlapping.
Now, and Shannon lived into the 2000s. So he saw.
Who's that?
Claude Shannon lived into the 2000s. Like he lived to see the whole world bloom around his.
Yeah, like he was there.
Around his invention.
Like he invented computers, but then was there for the birth of the internet. Okay.
I just went back to my high school reunion, my 40th high school reunion. And I think everybody knows that hair loss affects men differently, and it affects a lot of men over the course of their lives. And I think people who lose their hair young reckon with it. But as you get to your 40th reunion, almost everyone is losing their hair in some way or another. And the different styles of losing your hair really become apparent in a room where people are taking candid photographs of all their old friends, you know, clustered in little groups, having pleasant chats. And it's nice to look at your reunion photographs, but really you're scanning the room and you just see everybody's like little hidden bald spots, or, you know, it's almost impossible. I'm not somebody that's like managing or monitoring other guys' hair, but it's just kind of unavoidable to see the different ways that every man my age is balding. And I think for a lot of guys who've made it into their 50s and believed about themselves that they still had a full head of hair, some of those bald spots are really getting under their skin. And you can tell primarily by who or what photographs get reposted and which ones don't. But I was able at my reunion, in talking to a couple of guys candidly about their hair, to I was able to recommend to them Hims. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil, things that are proven to work. Hims has the real stuff, prescription strength medication. It brings expert care straight to you online with a personalized treatment plan for your individual circumstances, wherever it is you are on your hair loss journey. Hims can help you find the right hair growth, hair regrowth treatment. And it has like flexible options. It's got, provider support, online support 24/7. It's really just very straightforward, very transparent. So what I recommend to all of my friends who are similarly on a hair loss journey is go to hims.com/omnibus. That's HIMS.com/omnibus. Hims also has affordable care for weight loss, for erectile dysfunction. But really, hair loss is what we're talking about today. Go to hims.com/omnibus for your free online visit. Do it today. Featured products do include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription is required. Individual results may vary. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. That's hims.com/omnibus.
Ron Graham also came up with like an extension of Claude Shannon's theorem of juggling, which didn't just base around like just the normal cascade, which is the three balls going in like the, you know, figure of eight infinity kind of thing. They came up with a new thing here. Let me see if I can find it here. It's called Juggling Drops and Descents. And he's like one of four authors of this, along with Colin Wright and David Eisenbud and Joe Buhler. And they came up with something which is now known as Siteswap, which is the mathematical formula for creating and then error checking juggling patterns. The people who juggle and come up with site swaps and come up with these new patterns and get together and do club passing and all this kind of stuff, their brain is being tickled by the same thing that tickles the brains of mathematicians who work on information science and who program the internet and work on the foundational parts of the internet. It's not, they're not connected physically and they're not connected, whatever, they're connected in the brains of the people who invented this. It's like, it's not an accident that the same person who has the brain to come up with, you know, the information theory also was a juggler. I do think these things are connected in a way which is like, it's not provable, but like there is something going on in juggling, which is like this, it's like a representation of what's going on inside the, like the information theory. That kind of, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah, I do. Yeah.
That's the crossover. Juggling is like a physical embodiment of something which is on the verge of chaos, but can be understood and controlled via mathematics.
And so did juggling then continue to play? Are there jugglers all around us now? Are there
should we speed run through some more of these so I don't need to get into so much detail here?
Please do.
Do you know Salesforce? Do you know Salesforce? Is that a big company?
Of course. Yes, it is a huge company.
Got a big tower in San Francisco last time I was there.
It does. Like, a tower that's kind of, I think, sinking into the ground and is 90%.
Mark Benioff, founder and CEO of Salesforce, which is apparently, I saw a note here, is the world's second biggest software company, apparently.
Isn't that insane?
Internet services, they do like run half of the companies in America. The first application, the first bit of software that Mark Benioff sold was called How to Juggle. And he did it when he was a high school student. He wrote a program called How to Juggle and he sold it to some computer magazine for $75. There you go. Whoa. Mark Benioff, founder of Salesforce. Bram Cohen, have you ever heard of BitTorrent?
Yes, of course.
BitTorrent.
I use that in my music land.
Yeah, you wanna chop chop up files for them to be like stored on other people's computers. And then the same guy was like, hey, wait a second. We can download them faster and switch them around. And we can do a whole foundation of movie file sharing and all of that kind of stuff. Bram Cohen turns out also a juggler. Now he's made his money from BitTorrent and crypto and stuff like that. He's a
He's just juggling gold bars.
He's a hobby mathematician and a hobby juggler. You know, he does juggling work. He writes about it on his blog, or used to as well. So that's another one as well. This is a story which I found out about by being around at the time, was that there's a the juggling information service was a website which turned up in 1994. When was the website? When was the internet invented? Like right then. It's like one of the first ever websites, which was called juggling.org. And that was created by someone called Barry Bacalore. And he was a computer programmer and, you know, internet pioneer kind of guy, software engineer. And he came up with this idea of like, hey, what if we have a picture? We're getting to pictures on the internet. What if we had a picture of the world? And when you click on somewhere on the picture on the world, it works out where you clicked and then does like trigonometry to work out what's closest to your point in space, like where you clicked, and will give you results of the things that are closest to you on the map when you click on a map. Now, this sounds, of course, exactly like Google Maps and literally every map bit of software.
Every map.
But you have to have like the earliest example of click on a map and get the closest result to this. Okay. And so this is the earliest version of click on a map and find a result. And if you can do it, you to find juggling meetings around the world. And you can still go there. Even to this day, Barry Bacalore has kept this website, juggling.org, online. All the information is out of date, but it's kept there as a little historical thing from 1994, which is click on a map and get a closest result. So much so that when Google, for their Google Maps, was being sued, and Microsoft as well for their mapping stuff, they were being sued by a lawsuit to invalidate, like someone thought, hey, I've got a patent on click on a map and find the closest result. Barry Bacalore was brought in as an expert witness in the trial to say, look, I was doing this. Like I had a company, Nowhere Systems. So Nowhere Systems was like an early .com startup that he had in the 90s, which is sort of like, if you've got lots of shops, we'll supply the map information that click on the map, find the locus, the closest, you know.
I know for a fact that I used some of this technology at the time, because click on a map was, you know, it was key to.
It could have been Barry Bacalore's code. Now, here's the next little thing. Barry Bacalore made his millions, bought his mansions, you know, and did all that with the dot-com stuff as well. So much so that when Russian jugglers Vova and Olga Galchenko were appearing in the United States, and they were like, we need somewhere to stay. He's like, you can stay with us, provided them with funding. In the end, adopted them. So he actually adopted Vova and Olga Galchenko so they could stay in America. Because first they were there on some like gifted persons visa or something.
Right, right.
And so then he adopted them and then they stayed in, lived with him, grew up with him as, you know, teenagers, went to school and stuff like that. And so, yeah, Vova and Olga Galchenko have got this direct link there that they were adopted into this, you know, dot-com millionaire family.
And did they go on to become dot-com millionaires themselves?
What do you think? Like the best jugglers in the world, world record holding child prodigy jugglers who in the teenage years were appearing on Ellen and on the opera show and all these TV shows. What is their course in life? What is their course in life? Did they go on to become professional jugglers?
Aren't they crypto the billionaires? Something must have happened.
Well, I checked their LinkedIn. Vova Galchenko is now, he is now senior director of engineering at Box, which is like a Dropbox kind of thing. So he's now senior director of engineering at an internet infrastructure company. And Olga Galchenko is a software engineer at Airbnb. So there you go. Best jugglers in the world. Literally, in 2003, 2004, these were the world's greatest club juggling passing duo. They were like 13, 15 years old or something like that. They were performing around the world, TV appearances, you know, winning all the competitions, winning the IJA competitions when I was there, you know, when I visited the IJA festival in 2004. And now no longer professional jugglers. head of, like, director of, senior director of engineering and software engineering. And that's their continuing life. And this happens to so many jugglers that I know. Like, almost, like, I'd say 50% of the professional jugglers I know are professional jugglers for a few years. You know, they do that kind of stuff and they all retire. And then half of them become like physical trainers and physiotherapists. And the other half become software engineers and continue on with their, you know, computer science degrees, computer maths degrees, and get jobs in that way. Like, honestly, 50% of the jugglers that I know are like software engineers or work in like science and mathematics and stuff like that.
So, but you have never, you've never personally felt that you're, that the juggling architecture in your mind has easily transferred over to being a software or computer polymath.
Certainly not computer polymath, but I have built websites. I've done programming and stuff. I, you know, just off my own back, even though I did music at university and a professional juggler, I learned Python scripting and built websites for juggling reasons, you know, for like, there's a juggling competition that I run called Fight Night Combat, which is like a martial arts juggling kind of thing. And we have like 50 tournaments per year and we've had rankings and I built a website for that. And so, yeah, I have written entire websites and, you know, thousands of lines of code working on like a sports league ranking system, you know, like based on the tennis computer ranking.
Yeah, you just toss this off as like, oh yeah, well, I'm not a computer guy, but I have written thousands of lines of code.
Thankfully, and here's a big turns out, Claude, I don't touch that code anymore. There's a bug in the website and it's like, Claude, why is this not working? And Claude comes back like 3 minutes later. He's like, oh yeah, I've rewritten it. It works now. And I do want to check it. It's like, great. I can, you know, Claude, thank you very much, Claude Shannon, for inventing large language models and Anthropic for making a thing that now all of this stuff can be out of my head and I can use my brain for other more important things like podcasting with John.
It does feel like if you have incorporated juggling and martial arts, all you need to do is bring in breakdancing and you will have the, you will break Instagram. You will own the internet for all times. Can you just add that one third element?
Yeah, it does happen like sometimes where like the Diabloist, they have the Diablo battle, which is like a breakdance kind of like b-boy battle, and this Diabloist going up against you. That's like a really fun event. No, combat juggling, it goes viral like every 2 or 3 years on the internet. It spreads around and I get like, you know, a million views on a video somewhere. and then it passes by and nobody hears about it again. And then 3 years later, people are like, holy whatever, combat juggling is a thing. And, you know, you get featured on TV shows and I get a bit of licensing money for some videos from back in the day and stuff. So it goes in loops. It goes in circles in that way.
Do we still live in a world that is ruled by like mathematical jugglers or juggling mathematicians?
They've done it. They conquered the world. Claude Shannon, you can't get any more than that. Like he invented the foundation of what became Siteswap and modern juggling. He also invented literally using Boolean algebra to come up with programming like that. And all these other guys after it is just in his shadow.
But I'm trying to figure out, is there a pipeline where jugglers are continuing to be, you know, inserted?
All these, like I know, like, how many, like, I went over to the Portland Juggling Festival 1 year and like all of those guys came up from San Francisco. It's sort of like, oh, you were the 30th employee at Google and you've been working at Apple for like all of those guys are still there. They're all members of the IGA. They all meet up and stuff, less so in Europe, but you know, there's the, there's a reason why the IGA keeps going on and keeps ticking on because they've got .com funding, you know, all these guys. So
this is crazy. I think avoided ever going to a juggling event because I still thought that they would all have been coming from clown school.
Nope.
And that it would smell like patchouli.
No.
And that it,
like, but I said, it's literally a juggling place is 50% of the people there are computer programs, mathematicians, you know, maybe like, you know, chemists or whatever like that.
Yeah. Right.
Or like super maths, STEM, whatever you want to say, like super engineering focused.
Well, and now then, I want to go. Now, are you going to be my juggling, like booking, like cruise? who's the person on the cruise that decides where you go? It's the love boat. What was her name? Julie. Are you going to be my Julie?
Cruises are different from my experience of cruising. I don't know what you're talking about here. No, there is no juggling cruise, you know.
Are you going to tell me when there's a juggling conference near Seattle? Can you keep an eye out for that? And if there's a juggling conference I can attend, will you send me a little ping?
Let me look it up now. Jugglingedge.com. I'm going to click here. Let's look at events. Let's go down, change regions to North America. Update list. Again, jugglers building websites for the jugglers. So Portland Juggling Festival, not far away, end of September, Portland Juggling Festival. It's one of the largest juggling conventions in the US. There's probably be like 500, 600 jugglers there. It's often at Reed College. Do you know Reed College?
All too well. Reed College is where the Simpsons television show was invented.
Yeah.
But Matt Groening went there, but it's also, they used to make their own LSD at Reed.
Yeah. Reed College is like one of the biggest places for juggling in the UK, in the USA. Also, where Steve Jobs went to college as well and dropped
That's
out.
Right.
So he was probably hanging out with jugglers at Reed College as well. So you can go along to, here you go, Portland. I'm sure there's others as well. But that's the ones that are on the list for this year.
Well, I will make an absolute point to go to the one in Portland this year. Portland is just a suburb of Seattle in terms of
there you go.
Whether or not I will go there for the opening of an envelope. And so it's on my list now. I feel like I'm a proto-Shannanian now, like I'm going to go spend the rest of the afternoon reading about Claude Shannon, and by the end of that,
There's some videos of, like, every newspaper article, a magazine article, it's always like, look at this guy riding a unicycle down the corridors of MIT, and he juggles, and also, he invented the computer system and internet, and all of them, like, lead with, he's a quirky guy who juggles three clubs, and all of his profile pictures of, like, you know, like, these magazine articles, it's always him holding juggling clubs or holding some juggling balls. It's like really funny.
I feel like I've been living in an alternate timeline where Claude Shannon could have been somebody that I knew all about starting 40 years ago.
Yeah. But 40 years ago, his invention hadn't impacted the entire world. Like the internet and computers had impacted some people's lives, but like you're Gen X, I'm like cusp Gen X as well. Like, I remember sitting like in school and they came and they said, check this out. And they brought this box and everybody got like a smaller box out. And you opened the box and took out something that was wrapped in a bit of plastic and you took the bit of plastic out and they're like, this is a calculator. And we were like, one plus one. And they're like, great, that's calculators. Now everybody put the calculators back in the packets, put them back in the box. They weren't back in the box and they left. And I didn't see another calculator for like 2 years. It was like a tech demo at our school of calculators. Like that world isn't the world that we live in now. That was, you know, Claude Shannon's world was like another 20 years off from right. When I was at primary school. And they did literally a lesson, which is look at a calculator. Claude Shannon's work is so foundational that as soon as you get like two steps above it, you're working in like computer languages and you're not touching those ones and zeros anymore.
Yeah, that's
right. I mean, you are kind of, but like that's what high level and low level languages talk about. You know, once you're down at that low level, when you're literally going, what, you know, punch cards. If you're doing punch cards, you're right in Claude Shannon world.
And that concludes juggling, the internet. Entry 677.EX0722, certificate number 28099 in the omnibus. Futurelings, whether you are a Boolean mathematician or a juggler or both or neither, we discourage you from spending any more time on the internet than you have to, unless you need to rewrite the code of your juggling website and you are at your wit's end, and Claude is going to do that work for you. Otherwise, in avoiding social media and the internet, there are only a couple of places I can recommend, and those are any place where futurelings congregate on Reddit, Discord, Facebook, elsewhere. Just look up futurelings, and you will find a dedicated and enthusiastic group. Luke, do you go on any of the omnibus social media?
Is I went over to patreon.com.
Yes.
And I'm a futureling and have emailed in various times for addenda shows. And so I suggest people head over to patreon.com/the name of the Patreon of this podcast.
which is Omnibus Project, patreon.com/omnibusproject. Yeah, you've submitted a lot of things there. And when we've done we did a long conversation about juggling before this episode that's available to Patreon subscribers.
Yeah, people can head over there, get to know the host of the next podcast. It comes up there in the feed. It's really fun.
If you want to do as Luke has done and submit a proposal for a show and for yourself as a co-host, yep, go to omnibusproject.com/submit, and there's a whole form there that you can fill out, and we'll potentially have you on as a co-host yourself.
Yes, it's been a lot of fun coming on here.
I do want to encourage people to email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com and send us physical mail, care of the Omnibus Project, to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084. Burien, Washington, 98166-9998.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.